Nuclear reporting. There are writers and editors around the country who cover nuclear issues, at least occasionally, and they often fall into talking points manufactured for them by the nuclear industry without knowing it. These have them emphasizing the power of our weapons, or our so-called need for them, or boosterism for new plutonium pits and arsenal infrastructure improvement. Or they use the words clean, green, carbon-free, advanced, and other false terms to describe nuclear energy, not understanding that they're passing along propaganda. But then you attend a summit for those who report on nuclear and are fortunate enough to have on hand a few activists who have been on the front lines of fighting against nuclear expansionism and the often ignored human aspect of the nuclear argument. And one downwinder tells you,
people need to realize have very real consequences for real human beings. So one thing I just really wanted to point out to reporters and others here is that you can never divorce the human suffering that will come from these weapons.
Well, when downwinder Mary Dixon from Utah, along with Just Moms STL founders Dawn Chapman and Karen Nickel, take on the job of putting a human face on an inhuman technology, you get a powerful explanation as to why it's so difficult to get the public to understand about that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special report on the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit, a two-day event held in Washington, D.C. that brought together more than 100 reporters, editors, representatives of government agencies and NGOs to take a deep dive into nuclear stories, hear from a wide range of experts, and put in place networks of contacts for future nuclear reporting. It was an unprecedented event, and I talked with presenters, activists, and reporters from around the country. We will also have a report on the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Nihon Hidanko, the Japanese Confederation of A-bomb and H-bomb Sufferers Organizations, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than we've yet heard from the incoming U.S. administration, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 10, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We start with today's leading nuclear story, the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Nihon Hidankyo. The Japanese Confederation of A and H Bomb Sufferers Organizations. It is a group that represents survivors of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was accepted by 92-year-old Nagasaki survivor Terumi Tanaka, co-chair of Nihon Hidankyo, who survived the bombing when only 13 years old. In his Nobel lecture today, he said, "It is the heartfelt desire of the Hibakusha that, rather than depending on the theory of nuclear deterrence, which assumes the possession and use of nuclear weapons, we must not allow the possession of a single nuclear weapon. I therefore plead for everyone around the world to discuss together what we must do to eliminate nuclear weapons and demand action from governments to achieve this goal." Norwegian Nobel Committee Chair Jørgen Vatne Fridnes said in introducing the laureates that it was important to learn from their testimony as the nuclear dangers grow. He said, "None of the nine countries that possess nuclear weapons, the United States, Russia, China, France, the United Kingdom, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea appear interested in nuclear disarmament and arms control at present. On the contrary, they are modernizing and building up their nuclear arsenals. He said the Norwegian Nobel Committee was calling upon the five nuclear weapons states that have signed the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the U.S., Russia, China, France, and the U.K., to take seriously their obligations under the treaty, and said others must ratify it. Friedness said, "It is naive to believe our civilization can survive a world order in which global security depends on nuclear weapons. The world is not meant to be a prison in which we await collective annihilation." We will have a link up to the full Nobel Peace Prize Award ceremony on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 703. Here in the U.S., the World Business Academy has released a report that details negative health trends in the area surrounding the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in San Luis Obispo County in Northern California. Cancer incidence in San Luis Obispo County rose from 0.4% below to 6.9% above the average for the state of California during the time period of 1988 through 1990 to 2003 to 2010. The current cancer rate is the highest in all 20 counties in Southern California. Melanoma incidence in San Luis Obispo County soared from 3.6% above to 130.2% above the state incidence rate during that same period of time, and now is the highest in all California counties. And in the 10 zip code areas in Santa Barbara County, closest to Diablo Canyon, there was a greater rise in the rates of infant mortality, low weight births, and total mortality than in the 5 zip code areas in the city of Santa Barbara, located approximately 90 miles from the reactors.
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
The Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, is reporting on how the Trump administration can make nuclear energy popular with women. They cite an unattributed report that claims that 56% of Americans are in favor of nuclear energy, but it's 70% of the men having a favorable opinion, with just 44% of women who are likely to be skeptical of nuclear energy. So, what's being used to convince women to go pro-nuke? Aesthetics! Quoting this article, two companies are expertly combining functionality with aesthetics, a surefire way to appeal to nuclear skeptical women. Here in the U.S., the Oklo Aurora prototype at the Idaho National Laboratory, slated to go online in 2027, but when has anything nuclear ever been achieved on time, let alone on budget, has been lauded for its sky chalet design. Ooh! And in the United Kingdom, luxury car company, can't you just feel those leather seats, is diversifying its portfolio with small modular nuclear reactors. Their prototypes, not built, just projected, occupy about 2 soccer fields. No word if they are to be painted Barbie pink. And no mention at all in this article of birth defects, infant mortality, low birth weight, or childhood cancers, let alone any word of what's to be done with the highly radioactive nuclear waste that will be created. But hey, aren't they cute? And that's why, independentwomensforum.org, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
In western Japan, the Chugaku Electric Power Company has restarted the number 2 reactor at its Shimane Nuclear Power Plant for the first time in 13 years. The reactor is the second boiling water reactor to be brought back online in Japan since the boiling water units at Fukushima Daiichi melted down in 2011. Also recently restarted was the Onagawa Nuclear Plant in northeastern Japan. And now 14 reactors in the country have restarted since new safety standards were established in 2013 following the triple meltdown accident at Fukushima. And as if the nuclear reaction and radioactive fallout from Fukushima weren't enough, workers at the plant found an unexploded bomb from World War II. It is believed to have been dropped by an American aircraft, as Fukushima was once a military base and thus a prime target of the U.S. military during World War II. At the United Nations, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky charged that Russian leader Vladimir Putin is planning to attack nuclear power plants in his country, warning of catastrophic consequences. Ukrainian intelligence issued a report that Putin seems to be planning attacks on the Ukrainian power plants and infrastructure, aiming to disconnect the plants from the power grid. Zelensky said, any critical incident in the energy system could lead to a nuclear disaster, a day that must never come. Also in Ukraine, an International Atomic Energy Agency vehicle en route to the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was hit by a Russian drone and severely damaged. IAEA head Rafael Grossi condemned the attack as unacceptable, as it attacked agency staff working to prevent a nuclear accident during the military conflict. Fortunately, there were no casualties or injuries. Now here's this week's featured special on the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit, held on December 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. On the first day, I was happy to meet up with Dawn Chapman and Karen Nickel, founders of Just Moms STL, a group that is fighting for cleanup of the still toxic World War II Manhattan Project radioactive waste that was dumped in their neighborhood and continues to be a health hazard. Just Moms has been in the forefront of fighting for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. Dawn was scheduled to speak that afternoon on the panel, The Hidden Health Impacts of Nuclear Weapons Production. But that morning, she was unexpectedly pulled away to Capitol Hill for some late-breaking meetings on RECA and the push to move it through Congress. Here was a nuclear story happening in the middle of a nuclear reporting summit, and Nuclear Hot Seat was first to get it. Dawn?
You had some very important meetings here in D.C. What is the latest on RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act?
The latest is that we have a series of bills next week that are hopefully going to pass through the Senate and the House, with which we could attach RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, to. And that while it did pass the Senate with a veto-proof majority, it still needs to get past the House. And the Speaker of the House is willing to put a RECA bill on the floor, but he wants all of the members to agree which one, which of course we all want the one that brings everybody. That's the one that passed the Senate.
And when you say everybody, you're talking about all the states where you have verifiable proof that the radiation, the fallout from nuclear bomb tests did happen.
That's correct. What we want is to bring in all the RECA communities that have been impacted and put us all under one umbrella, so to speak, in this bill. You know, none of us, we don't want to leave each other out, and we think we made a lot of progress with that. We know that Utah is and has been a tough state, but every meeting we have with them, we just move it just a little bit more. And so, you know, we think that we've almost got them to that point, but we know that we have the votes in the House of Representatives. So in the moment it comes onto the House floor, we will have the votes to pass it, which is huge.
And you still have the votes in the Senate.
This is correct. And while that's important is because should we add in another zip code or have to modify the bill, there is some talk that that modifying might happen, the addition of a zip code in Ohio, around the Piketon, Ohio plant, for instance, right? Any change requires passage again in the Senate. But with these monster bills that are about to go through, you know, you've got the defense bill, you've got hopefully a hurricane relief package, that has to go through the Senate as well. So if we attach it to one, then it sits on it, it goes through the Senate, and then goes through the House.
Wasn't this a technique that was tried before, only RECA was struck out of the larger legislative package?
It was. And that is always, this is again why we are here having meetings, because the different committees and places that if it is put on a package, that bill then goes that could remove it, hoping to have those meetings and get those people not to remove it this time.
We've also built a stronger coalition, too. Our coalition to get RECA passed continues to grow throughout the nation now.
When you say it's growing with other organizations, can you give us some examples?
The Navajo Nation, the uranium miners that weren't covered, our folks out west who areas that weren't covered under the first RECA bill, the original, the Tularosa Basin, So there's a lot of people out there that just didn't know the others existed. And now that we've all come together, whether it's in 2 weeks this passes or 2 months or 2 years, we won't stop. We're just going to continue to grow. And let's get it done now.
I vote for 2 weeks.
Me too.
I vote for 2 weeks as well. I think that one of the things we heard that might help with that is that we do have a new administration coming in, and they're going to have their own things that they want to get done. It is better for many to get this one out of the way. You know, I think we have been a lovable pain in the rear end of a lot of people, which is something we are very proud of. And we are happy to agitate and push that a little more if we have to.
What are you here to speak on this afternoon at the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit?
We are here to maybe give a different or perhaps accurate flavor perspective of what the true cost of designing and producing weapons and energy is and has been. And, you know, we are living proof of the harm, and to hopefully drive home the fact that we still, our community is undergoing a massive cleanup. And one thing that we've learned, there is no such thing as a cleanup. There is no such thing as 100% taking the radioactive waste that is in our community and being able to remove it. We don't have the engineering technology. So it's important people understand that this is one mess that, when made, cannot always be reversed, at least not completely. And there are consequences to production that exist whether or not the actual manufactured bomb gets dropped. There is a cost. There are lives that are put in harm's way, and it has a cost, a physical one.
It's almost as if the nuclear war is being waged against our own people in the process of making nuclear weapons.
It is, and, you know, and we get asked a lot by communities where, you know, some of the waste is being considered to be intermittently short-term stored. Well, tell us about what's going on in your community. It's almost been in our community for 100 years, and they don't know how to get it out. Because that's what they want to know. If something happens, they store it in our community and something happens, what are they willing to do? And really what you should ask yourself is, what can they do? Our science is limited when it comes to cleaning this stuff.
And that's the point you're going to be bringing up to the reporters who are assembled here today, more than 100 of them.
It is the point, as well as the point as to how to report on this issue and really put a human face to it. You know, there's some great data out there, and that's very important. But, you know, when you're trying to pass RECA like we are, people do not want to be dots on a map. You know, there are faces, there are real families and people. So to put the human story with the data and to do it in a way that's not, you know, exploiting the person, which is something you are very good at. Because you are, in fact, when we come across somebody who hasn't had a lot of experience with press or giving an interview, who is nervous, you are usually our first person we send them to, because you do such a great job, and it gets them very comfortable, and you are what we would consider to be a safe person.
I try.
You do a great job.
Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL. Note that the Outrider Summit was not specifically an anti-nuclear event. Rather, it was an exploration of the many facets of nuclear weapons and provided insights into how people we might not agree with frame and focus on nuclear. The first session, When Climate Change Threatens National Security, featured perspectives from those working on the nexus of nuclear weapons and climate. In the past year, forest fires have threatened weapons plants in the U.S., while warming ocean temperatures have and will continue to impact nuclear submarine operations in unexpected ways. The panel discussed the consequences of climate change on national security and strategies to anticipate and address them. One of the participants was Jamie Kwong. She is a fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She said, "Climate change could have mission-altering impacts on the U.S. nuclear deterrent, from sea level rise and flooding that could undermine ballistic missile submarines to wildfires that could threaten the single points of failure in the larger nuclear enterprise." Also on this panel was Carl V. D'Ambrosio. He's a retired commander of the U.S. Navy submarine force and made the point that because of Admiral Rickover's demand that nuclear-powered submarines are all built to the exact same standards with interchangeable parts and consistent operational procedures, they are much safer than the civilian commercial nuclear industry, which all went their competitive individual ways with inconsistency in design and institutional knowledge, all of which contribute to the accidents and problems that happen in civilian reactors. I won't be able to go over all of the participants and talking points, but we'll have a link up to the program on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 703. We will also, when permission is granted, link to any of the recordings of the participants so that you can check out their content directly. The second panel was A New U.S. President and New Nuclear Weapons, A Global Perspective. This panel broke down concerns about the incoming administration and Project 2025. The last remaining treaty between Russia and the United States expires in February 2026. Globally, the era of nuclear arms reductions that have characterized the past four decades has come to an end. The number of nuclear weapons assigned to military forces worldwide is now increasing again. Deteriorating relations and deepening hostilities are increasing nuclear risks, with frequent nuclear threats and renewed interest in quote-unquote tactical nuclear weapons for quote-unquote limited nuclear scenarios, and the possibility that more countries will decide to acquire nuclear weapons. Note that I learned that the smaller quote-unquote tactical nuclear weapons are about the same size as the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So they are not inconsequential, and whether they are limited or not is open for discussion. Will our next president resist or embrace a new nuclear arms race as the U.S. upgrades its 400 land-based ICBM nuclear missiles in Montana, Wyoming, and North Dakota? How does that already over-budget program, which will also see support and testing in Utah and Arizona, compared to nuclear stockpiles and capabilities in the eight other nuclear nations? No conclusions were reached. There was much speculation, and this is one panel you will want to listen to when it becomes available. The third session was the only one that spoke directly to concerns we deal with on this show about the impact of nuclear radiation on human beings. At this panel, The Hidden Health Impacts of Nuclear Weapons Production, Don Chapman blew a human-sized hole in the hearts and minds of many of the reporters there. We've already heard from Dawn about her emphasis on the need to put a human face on the nuclear story. This point was backed up by comments from the audience by Karen Nickel of Just Moms STL and Mary Dixon. She is an author, playwright, activist, and downwinder.
Mary, what has been your impression and what has struck you about the presentations that have been taking place here?
Well, first of all, I'm incredibly grateful to be here because I'm learning a lot, meeting a lot of people who are great connections. But one thing I noticed, especially in an early session, was kind of the blind spots some people have, especially people who come from a defense perspective or a nuclear energy perspective. And I listened to them and I just thought, where are the human beings that these weapons, that this power will ultimately affect? Because we know that all the way along that nuclear chain, from production to development to testing to where to store the waste, there will be casualties. And especially as we're entering a time when countries are vamping up their nuclear arsenals, the U.S. is certainly vamping up its, and there's also talk of actually using weapons, whether it's a threat or it's serious, remains to be seen. And then we're talking about resuming nuclear testing under the Project 2025. So these things people need to realize have very real consequences for real human beings. So one thing I just really wanted to point out to reporters and others here is that you can never divorce the human suffering that will come from these weapons.
How was that message received by the reporters you spoke with?
You know, they listened. The reporters I spoke with listened. They heard. And they talked about, you know, you've got to put a human face on it. So I think they understood that, especially just telling them the stories are so important for them to hear, for them to report, because nobody will care unless they meet the people it's happened to.
How important do you feel it is for them to actually meet face to face somebody who was not only affected by it, but who can speak about it as effectively as you do?
I think it's incredibly important that they hear it from someone who can say it in a way that they'll listen to. It's incredibly important. There was a sociologist who said that 100 deaths, 1,000 deaths, 1,000,000 deaths, they're numbers. But for people to really care, they have to hear the story of one person. That's what makes people care. So hopefully, I've made some of them care.
Mary Dixon, a downwinder from Utah. Also on this panel was Sebastian Philippe. He is research scholar of the Program on Science and Global Security at Princeton University. He's the one who created the map of radiation contamination from nuclear testing that has been so helpful in the RECA battle. And we'll have a copy of that map on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 703. After lunch and another round of networking with reporters, came one of the highlights of the summit, asking the right questions and finding overlooked stories, nuclear treaties, the Nobel Peace Prize, and the imagery of nuclear weapons. This featured a one-on-one interview with Beatrice Finn. She is best known as executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, when it won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. This year, Finn founded Lex International, a philanthropic fund to develop and strengthen international law to solve global challenges. She serves as its director, as well as being senior fellow, United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research. I was able to speak with Beatrice Finn before the panel to learn of her most recent work on the photography used by news media to depict nuclear weapons and what a recent study reveals.
Beatrice, where are you now and what are you doing?
Well, in reality, I'm like one floor down underneath the ICAN office, so I'm still very close and I'm still on the board of ICAN. So I'm very involved, but I'm setting up a new philanthropic fund that is working a little bit broader than nuclear weapons, but mostly weapons and the rules of war. So the Geneva Conventions, we're trying to build more public awareness of what you're actually allowed to do in warfare and what you're not allowed in warfare, and sort of build more, you know, public pressure to keep to the laws of war, which I feel is very desperately needed right now.
What brings you here to this event today?
Well, we've recently, and like nuclear weapons is still the big core issue for me. The fund has commissioned some research into images and nuclear weapons. What kind of images do media use when reporting about nuclear weapons? And what does that say? And what kind of prejudice do we put into pictures around this weapon? So I'm going to do a little presentation here for all the participants about kind of what are the common pictures that we see and what pictures are we not seeing around nuclear weapons.
I would propose, and I've mentioned this to Alistair Burnett a number of times, that the pictures that we see from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are extremely scrubbed. They were after the cleanup. And there is footage available. I do have some stills that I took from the Japanese newsreel footage that actually showed the skulls, the bones, the heaps, the remnants of human beings. And I was wondering if in your consideration of images, that has come to the fore and that has been considered so people understand it's not a matter of, oh, gee, there's a lot of rubble and bombed out buildings, but there are a lot of dead and bombed out people.
Yeah, and I think that we see, of course, people's strong reactions to pictures from Ukraine, from Gaza right now, seeing how it shifts your perceptions when you actually see the impact of these bombs and you can see the people and real people that you can identify with. So I think absolutely the pictures from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they were suppressed, you know, for a long time and weren't allowed to be shown for a reason. But I also think it's important to, so that's one big thing. We need to show what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's also a lot of pictures from nuclear test sites that shows the impact of nuclear testing on indigenous communities, on people on Pacific Island states, for example. That's also very important to show. And then also, I think there's more also, it's not just to show the consequences, but also the people behind the bomb, the people who are building the bombs. I mean, these factory workers, it's CEOs, weapons companies, you know, they're so void of humanity, these weapons. You never see a person in these pictures, and unless it's like one of the nine leaders. So that also makes us feel like there are no people involved, and therefore I can't change anything. So it's the images also, we need to look at the weapons contractors, we need to see how they look like and where they work and the facilities and the local communities where you have the production plants. In this country, for example, where you have the missile silos, who lives there? How does that look, the local community? I have one picture that I want to show, which is a place of a production facility that had a radiation leak. And where you can see they are measuring radiation, and next to it is a playground. I mean, it's a very impactful photo that we don't usually see, because we see these missiles pointing somewhere else, right? And that's the image that we have of nuclear weapons.
I was at Three Mile Island when it happened. And sometime in the year after that, I met a photographer who was actually hired by nuclear facilities to take pictures. And he was under the mandate that any picture he had, any picture that he took, that there be blue sky, no clouds, because that could give the impression that maybe there was an emission or an explosion or something. And if possible, get live animals, not human beings, but cows, sheep, anything he could into the foreground to imply that this is fine and it supports life.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you've nailed about the images is that that's exactly what's going on in connection with the bomb, that we get to see, as we saw pictures this morning, the missiles and the planes and all of this firepower, but we don't get to see what it did to the people who created it and what it could potentially do to the people on the other end.
Exactly. And also nuclear weapons. I mean, if you think about it, who takes photos of nuclear weapons? It's the military. And it's their photographers. And they have an agenda with that. This is also, why is Russia or North Korea rolling out their big missiles on a parade? And that's the photos we see from there. I mean, it's a propaganda effort in many ways. And, of course, we can't go into a weapons facility and take other types of photos. They won't let us in, of course. So there is a difficulty to get any other photos of nuclear weapons. But I think that we can be very creative, and photographers could be very creative, and news editors can be very creative in like thinking about how we see this. And we also seen this in climate change. 10 years ago, the standard photo that accompanied an article about a new IPCC report on global warming would be a beach or sun chairs or sun umbrellas. That was very common. And now, of course, we laugh at that. It's like, no, it's droughts and flooding and catastrophe. We're looking at the impact, not just it's going to get warmer. Right? That's not what climate change is. It's not just about the temperature going up. It's about all of the consequences of that and how that messes with our ecosystems. So we're trying to kind of just, this is our first attempt, right, to really like look at the pictures from a different perspective and start talking to people. And I'm also very interested in hearing what people, how people respond to it, and if they feel like this makes sense or not makes sense, or yeah. So it's a new project, but I'm very excited about it.
Is there a way that people who are listening to Nuclear Hot Seat might be able to access those photos and perhaps give you some feedback?
We are going to put this out. We haven't done it yet. We haven't published this yet. So we're just still in the kind of pre-stage of that. But otherwise, you can go and follow me on social media platforms. I will post the reports when we publish them eventually. And maybe Outrider will publish this presentation as well.
And do you see yourself doing more work with Outrider in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is really, I think media is such an instrumental part. And it's how people interpret the world. It's like how we write and describe it. So I think that media has a really important job in not just taking the government's talking points on nuclear weapons and really start asking critical questions.
Beatrice Finn. Her presentation proved important and immediately applicable by several of the reporters I spoke with. Here's one.
Reese Williams. I am from New York City, and I'm an independent journalist.
What kind of nuclear coverage have you done in the past, or has yours been primarily in conjunction with climate change?
Oh, gosh. Well, in the past, I did a story for Outrider specifically that was an interview, a Q&A, with a gentleman who wrote a book about the day after. And the whole piece was sort of centered around how fictional storytelling can influence people's perceptions about nuclear warfare. And obviously that movie had a unique effect at its time when it came out. And so a lot of what he talked about was how we can now in the 21st century, learn from that and what more multimedia storytelling we can use to talk about nuclear warfare. Now I'm working on a story about atomic veterans, the history of, the stories of, especially in the context of the Trump administration wanting to restart nuclear testing.
What did you come here hoping to find or expecting to find, and what has been your biggest takeaway so far?
You know, I was a COVID college kid, and so I honestly have not had a lot of opportunities to get together with other journalists and experts in person. And so when Robert and I were talking and he told me about the conference, I think honestly the big incentive for me was to actually network and chat with people in person, because it's just been sort of a rare occasion for me. But also because this is not really a beat that I have been super focused on. And so it's just wonderful and stimulating and enlightening to come to a place and talk about things that are, you know, normally something that I think, oh, that's so beyond me, but now it's been so educational. I think honestly yesterday I thought that the keynote session was fantastic. I thought Beatrice was so well spoken. I mean, obviously well accomplished, but I think she stood out among everyone as just a wonderful presenter and a very easy person to listen to, and she made stuff that is really complicated really accessible, and that's sort of why I love science journalism.
On Friday, we started with plenty of time for mingling with reporters and editors, and I continued to let them know what Nuclear Hot Seat could do to help them develop stories that did not ignore the oppositional perspective or the human element. For example, I spoke with more than one reporter interested in writing on uranium mining issues, and I'm already in the process of connecting them with contacts on Navajo Nation and the International Uranium Film Festival, which has presented many documentaries on uranium mining in Africa. One reporter was following the story of the radioactive contamination at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, Ohio, but didn't know to contact Joe Mangano of Radiation and Public Health Project on the elevated cancer rates in the area, or researcher Dr. Michael Ketterer, who discovered the radioactive americium at the Zahn's Corner Middle School that forced it to be shut down. And what's so suspicious about that radioactive school's recent sale to a Christian ministry? In essence, I was working on the hoof as a kind of nuclear switchboard to help connect these writers with credentialed, genuine experts who contradicted the highly promoted pro-nuclear drumbeat. Friday began with two breakout sessions. The one I attended was Protect Your Digital Life, an essential security workshop for modern journalists with Diana R. Fuentes. She is executive director of Investigative Reporters and Editors, or IRE. Threats to journalists are real and growing, and learning how to safeguard our lives both online and in the physical world reality proved to be a real eye-opener. The other breakout session, How to Find Nuclear Information in Unexpected Public Records, was led by Taylor Barnes. She is field reporter for military affairs and the defense industry for Inkstick Media. I spoke with her briefly before the session.
My name is Taylor Barnes. I'm here from Inkstick Media, and I live in Atlanta. I came here, one, I was invited. I'm a speaker here. I'm speaking about public records. And two, I work in the field. I'm often working on my own. And it's really nice to just be with like-minded people and to sort of get a broader view of our field and hear about everyone else's work and get out of my, sorry to use the cliche, my silo sometimes.
What's one thing that stands out for you that has happened so far?
I really enjoyed the talk yesterday by Beatrice Finn from, you know, formerly from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, about the images that we associate with and that we have available to us in the media to represent nuclear weapons. And I think it's such an urgent task to, of course, visualize them how they accurately are, which I know through my reporting, which is, you know, produced by humans and made by real people across the U.S., across nuclear weapon states, often in precarious labor conditions. That's going to be one of the stories I'll be talking about today. So I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed, you know, imagining what other kind of images we could hopefully use to represent this.
Taylor's breakout session was How to Find Nuclear Information in Unexpected Public Records, pointing out that sometimes the best investigative reporting doesn't come from federal FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, but from SEC filings and local records research. She discussed strategies and hidden gems that have been valuable to her work and that will help other reporters navigate their investigations into complicated issues. The next session was entitled The Future is Now, artificial intelligence, and national security. It examined AI applications in nuclear security, which are already happening in everything from mapping to advanced targeting, war gaming, strategies, and some surprising applications. The panel explored what's currently happening and what's possible in the future of AI and nuclear security. I got a snippet of time to talk with one of the panelists, specifically to learn where she's coming from.
My name is Leah Walker. I'm the lab director for the Berkeley Risk and Security Lab. I was invited here to be a speaker, so I spoke on AI and nuclear integration. And I came here hoping to find not only other nuclear experts, but find people from journalism who are willing to engage on these issues, and I found a lot of them. So hopefully that's going to be the start of some meaningful relationships where I can make sure that our research at the lab is being translated by these fantastic journalists.
And would you say that your stance is pro-nuclear, anti-nuclear, or neutral?
I would say my stance is, unfortunately, these weapons are here and we have to deal with them.
Alas, she's right. The final session, Nuclear Weapons Then and Now, in Space and on Earth, was a one-on-one between General C. Robert Bob Koehler, retired, former commander of U.S. Strategic Command, and W.J. Bill Hennigan, correspondent for the New York Times Opinion, and the man who wrote the brilliant recent article, The Price. While it was interesting to listen to the general explain how the nuclear command chain worked, from presidential order to implementation, and he was part of that chain, I would have appreciated having someone interview Bill Hennigan on his work, which ranks as the best and most comprehensive information we have on the exact size, nature, and location of America's nuclear arsenal. One of Nuclear Hot Seat's regular contributors was also in attendance both days, and that was Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear. Here is her regular feature, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, which this week is inspired by the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit, and asks the question, why are we protecting nukes from climate change rather than abolishing them?
The climate crisis is upon us. That much is evident. What is also apparent is that we are not at all ready to cope with it, despite anticipating the very disasters we are now facing, while at the same time watching our leaders stubbornly refuse to take the swift and necessary action that could have averted the worst of it. The climate crisis, unabated and inadequately managed, is going to kill us. Indeed, it already is. It won't kill all of us, at least not right away, and needless to say, the communities harmed the most and the soonest will be the least resourced to protect themselves, rather than those responsible for the destruction at hand. Then there's the prospect of nuclear war. While that may not kill all of us immediately either, depending on the scale, it would likely destroy everything needed to sustain life on Earth, including agriculture and access to clean water. So our eventual extinction would be inevitable. But inside the US Defense Department and at some of the country's most powerful think tanks, the concerns are less about that than what might become of our nuclear weapons arsenal under ever more violent climate conditions. Much work, and of course money, therefore, is being spent considering ways to protect our nuclear triad from becoming inoperable as sea levels rise and storms, fires, and floods worsen. At a recent Outrider Foundation-hosted Nuclear Reporting Summit here in Washington, D.C., panelists from within the world of the nuclear priesthood discussed the challenges of, quote, looking for a climate plan for a nuclear deterrent. Specifically, they discussed the Kings Bay nuclear submarine port on the U.S. Georgia coast and how, with wilder weather and turbulent seas, the transferring of missiles to the nuclear-armed Trident submarine fleet or even their ability to come into port might be disrupted. This deeply ironic problem, how to protect the worst weapons of mass destruction from destruction, set me thinking about its evil twin, commercial nuclear power, and what is happening in that sector. Because while the nuclear weapons complex, both government and the private sector, are taking climate change seriously as a threat to their survival, never mind that what they do is a threat to all of ours, the nuclear power sector is doing exactly the opposite. The US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to evaluate and, as its name suggests, regulate safety in the nuclear power plant sector, considers the possible impact of a worsening climate on both currently operating and potential new reactors as entirely outside its purview. While the nuclear industry is busy promoting itself as a false solution to the climate crisis, it desperately doesn't want you to notice just what a liability it is under more extreme climate conditions. And the NRC is more than willing to aid and abet in that cover-up. I know this partly because my organization, Beyond Nuclear, is busy in court challenging license extensions for some of the country's aging nuclear power plants, whose owners want to keep them running for 60 or even 80 years. And the dirty secret the nuclear industry desperately doesn't want you to know is that nuclear power plants are going to get more dangerous and more risky as our weather worsens. So the NRC is busily taking down previously public documents under the excuse of national security if any of these might suggest climate vulnerabilities at civil nuclear sites. Behind closed doors, I'm pretty certain that the civil nuclear sector is just as worried as the nuclear weapons complex about the dangers posed to their facilities by climate chaos. The difference is they don't want you to know about it because it rather spoils their convenient little narrative about being the answer to climate change. Now, you could argue that given nuclear weapons and nuclear power, and of course climate change, are here now, we should be doing all we can to protect them. That's surely in our immediate best interests. But there also needs to be an acknowledgement that if we are to survive the climate crisis, then the other goal must be to do away with everything that could make it catastrophically worse. That would mean abolishing nuclear weapons and ending our use of nuclear power. That's the discussion that isn't, but should be, happening. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
As the event ended, I asked a number of attendees at random what their experience of the summit had been.
I'm Dan Ackerman. I'm a freelance reporter from Boston, and I'm here because I cover science and technology, but I have done very few stories on nuclear stuff, and I've run into editors who are not that excited about it. So just trying to find story ideas that are compelling and important.
Are you looking specifically for weapons, or are you into reactor issues as well?
Both. I've found that civilian nuclear energy is an easier sell for editors because it's more visible and understandable. So I think I'm particularly here just to learn more about the weapon side of things and find story angles on that.
Sometimes I was surprised to cross paths with reporters I had dealt with in the dawn of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Patrick Malone, senior investigative reporter with the Seattle Times, and came here to reconnect with some old nuclear sources and fire up some ideas about what we can do in the year ahead with the new administration and other changes. And, you know, I think I'm leaving with 4 or 5 story ideas. I don't know if I'll even get to them all year, but it was a highly relevant conference and one where I met a lot of other great journalists.
Was there anything in particular that stood out for you?
You know, I think what unexpectedly grabbed my attention was the relevance of cyber vulnerabilities in local communities.
That one of your stories?
We'll see.
Good afternoon. My name is John Lettman. I'm a freelance independent reporter. I'm from the island of Kauai in Hawaii. I came out here because I cover nuclear weapons and climate issues, and it was a great experience to hear from so many different voices and bring up a lot of important issues that are frequently overlooked or issues I've not heard before, and it gives me a new way to think about this, and so I look forward to lots of great stories coming out of this experience.
Was there anything in particular that popped for you in the information you heard?
There was a lot in a very short period of time, so I'll be looking forward to going back and watching the video again and thinking about the many issues that were raised. But some of the issues in terms of how nuclear weapons are framed and dispelling some of the myths that have been perpetuated over many years and decades, so I think that was an important point.
Hi, I'm Fiona Samuels. I work at Chemical and Engineering News, which is part of the American Chemical Society. I came in today from Maryland, and I was hoping to learn more about the policies around nuclear weapons and energy, and I feel like I have learned a lot about that. And importantly, that highlighting human stories in nuclear coverage is vitally important.
What stories are you working on now, or do you think you might be as a result of being here?
I would love to work on a story about how uranium comes from a mine and ends up in a bomb or in a nuclear reactor for an energy plant. The whole lifespan of that uranium.
Are you in touch with Navajo Nation at all?
I am not personally, but I do know about the uranium mining in the Navajo Nation and a little bit about the consequences of that. What I've come away with is that although that there is a national security threat around nuclear weapons, the day-to-day threat is from the elements themselves, from mining, from refinement, and from testing. And that is where individuals' lives have been changed forever across the United States and globally.
My name is Soren Messner-Zeidel. I'm currently on a transitional grant with Open Philanthropy for AI governance. I'm formerly of the Brookings Institution as a digital lead.
What brought you here to this event, and what do you feel you've gotten out of it?
To some degree, it was opportunism. I was simply invited. I am transitioning into AI governance, so that's where my focus is. There is a lot of intersection with nuclear and AI. There's going to be more and more of that. Obviously, there's CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and risks with bad actors, jailbreaking models, as well as, you know, actual technology infrastructure within launch capabilities. So it's coming, and it's going to become more significant. And I think it's sensible for a variety of pragmatic reasons to build competency in this area. What did I get out of this? The biggest thing, I think, at a macro level is that nuclear seems very neglected as a cause area. There doesn't seem like there's a ton of private funding going into it. Yeah, there's lots of public money and infrastructure that goes into it. It doesn't seem like it's really in the public consciousness much, despite the risks. Yes, there are journalists writing about it. Yes, the stories get traction. It doesn't sound like there's all that many. So just my overall takeaway relative to other catastrophic risk profiles right now is that nuclear seems to be out of balance with the probability of the likelihood of a catastrophe relative to the attention and traction that it gets. So that's kind of just my overall takeaway.
Sounds like a story to be written.
And so many more stories. I left the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit with gratitude for the work they're doing and the people doing it, including Robert K. Elder, president and CEO of the Outrider Foundation, Chief Climate Officer David Vitze, who kept the event's on-site issues under control, tech wizard Andy Adams, and all those who worked behind the scenes to bring this first-ever Nuclear Reporting Summit to fruition. Next year, it will take place in October at the Titan Ranch, with meetings inside a Cold War-era Titan II missile silo near Little Rock, Arkansas. Not your typical conference location. And I hope to be able to attend that too. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 10, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and fill out the yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one and only one email, which contains the link and a short description of the show's content. You can also do it by signing up on your favorite podcast channel. But either way, you deserve to have the most current information on nuclear issues. You can help, too. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. If you're a reporter and need a source or direction to your subject matter on a previous Nuclear Hot Seat, please use the same email. Let me know. Happy to help. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we always need your help. And anything we receive in excess of our monthly running costs will go directly to getting me to New York for the United Nations Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Anything you can contribute helps, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Heartistry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. We're going out this week on a song by musical satirist Tom Lehrer. He was a major force for sanity through humor in the mid-1960s, and in 2022, he released all his recordings into the public domain. So here we share one of my favorites, So Long Mom, I'm Off to Drop the Bomb. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you That is Beatrice Finn said in her presentation to all of the reporters present. If you're not upsetting people in power, you're not doing your job. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can watch me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.